We can start. Let's go. Well, hello everybody. It's a real personal pleasure to today have Benedetta Spina, who is doing the last year of the PhD in Germany, whatever last year means in Germany. I not have a look at the list of participants anyway. Maybe most of you remind Benedetta, who spent a year at LAM during the Erasmus placement, the last year of the undergraduate studies that she did at the University of Padua. So now she's in Bonn and working with Cristina Porciani on the topic of her talk today. I invite everyone to interrupt Benedetta at any time for questions, so don't wait for the end, please. Thank you, Benedetta.
Okay, so thanks for the nice introduction, Carlo, and thanks for having me here today. I just wanted to say a few things about what I'm doing, what I've been doing for the past 2 years now in Bonn. And so I just wanted to start with a brief introduction about immunization epoch. Of course, I'm sure you already know most of these things, just a small recap. So we know that the universe was neutral until 0.5, 1 giga year after the Big Bang, when the first objects, so quasars, galaxies, and so on, appeared and started ionizing the neutral intergalactic medium, and so the neutral hydrogen, the helium, and so on. And we see the effects of this ionization today on large scale, but not only. We know about this epoch that ionization started at a redshift between 15 and 20, let's say, depends on the model, and ended for hydrogen at a redshift around 6, pretty much. It's a bit different for helium, but we'll talk a bit about that later. And what's interesting is that we can study this epoch in the evolution of the universe, looking at the hyperfine transition in the hydrogen atom. So the hydrogen atom undergoes change in this configuration in which the spin of the proton and the electron, which at the beginning are anti-parallel, then became parallel because of this spin flip of the electron here. And when these happen, a photon is emitted with a specific wavelength of 21 centimeter today for hydrogen. Something similar happens also for helium, so for singularly ionized helium. And in that case, the frequency we observe, it's higher. So it's around 8.66 gigahertz. But anyway, whichever is the species we are considering, the fluctuations of this brightness temperature can be written in this way. So it depends on the temperature of this spin flip, of the temperature of the CMB, and on the optical depth of the species we are considering. Of course, in this limit, we can approximate the equation in this nice way. And after some calculations, the fluctuations around of the brightness temperature can be written in this nice way. So the first term here is just constant, and it depends on the characteristic of the element we are considering, either hydrogen or helium. Okay, for example, for neutral hydrogen, we get that this coefficient is around 9 millikelvin, while for singularized helium, around 5 × 10⁻⁴ millikelvin. The equation here also depends on some other quantities, of course, so the fraction of the species, the underlying overdensities, and the redshift we are considering. Okay, so let's take a look at these two processes. So first of all, the hydrogen ionization. As I said at the beginning, these started at a redshift around 17 and ended at redshift 6. The problem here is that the signal is contaminated by the galactic and exogalactic foregrounds that are usually several orders of magnitude brighter than the H1 signal. But at the same time, hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, so it really makes sense to study the hydrogen ionization. Something similar happens also for singularly ionized helium. So depending on the model, we think that it started a bit later, so the redshift around 6 and ended at the redshift around free, so it's closer to us in some way. But again, we'll see this better later. Because of the higher rest frequency of the hyperfine transition in the synchronized helium atom, the foreground contamination is minimized compared to the one in the hydrogen case. It's true that helium is not as abundant as hydrogen, but it's convenient to study this process because of the high spontaneous decay rate of the synchronized helium atom. What is also very interesting right now is that we can observe these epochs, these processes with current and future radio telescopes. And this kind of observation, it's never been done before. So it's a really exciting time to look at now. What we can do is to use the line intensity mapping technique to study these processes. Why line intensity mapping? Because with line tomography, we can efficiently survey large cosmological volumes. It is very useful to test both the physics of ionization, so again, H1, synchronized helium, but also astrophysics processes, so star formation rate, for example, and so on, with different probes, so with different lines. So here I just wanted to mention a few of those, for example, CO, C plus, and the Lyman alpha. These of course have different wavelength and frequencies, and so we can observe different epoch and processes in the evolution of the universe with different probes. What is also very interesting right now is that we are not bounded anymore to galaxy surveys and neither to CMB studies, but we can really take a look at what is happening between those. So in the redshift range between, I don't know, 1 and 20 something, depending on the telescope we are considering. And the one I'm considering in my work is SKA1MID. This is an interferometer, but it can operate also in a single dish mode. It will cover a very large volume, so survey area of around 25,000 degrees squared. And regarding the hydrogen ionization, we'll observe in these redshift range, so between 0.3 and 3.06. Okay, so let's start talking about what I actually did in my PhD. The first project I work on and was published last year in collaboration with Cristiano Porciani and Carlo here is about the H1 LOMAS relation, redshift 1. So the aim of this work was to characterize the H1 content and spatial distribution through the H1 LOMAS relation in the post-serialization universe with, again, SKA1MID. Why is it important to study H1, its content and its spatial distribution? Well, because cold gas reservoirs in galaxies provide their fuel for star formation. Neutral hydrogen is the bulk of the cold gas. And so studying neutral hydrogen means providing constraints on galaxy assembly and evolution models. But where can we find the H1 in the post-ionization universe? So for a shift below 6, actually only within sub-shielded clouds inside galaxies and galaxy clusters, so in central and satellite galaxies in the diffuse gas. This is because, and we can see it here, this is the time goes in this direction, right? So at the beginning, everything is neutral, or the hydrogen in the universe is neutral, except for the one inside these clouds here, where the galaxies are. And then with time, everything starts to be ionized, so we don't find any more neutral hydrogen outside the these halos, but only within the halos, so in the gas that is surrounding the galaxies and the stars and so on. And we think there is a relation between the amount of neutral hydrogen within this halo and the dark matter halo itself, and that's the H1 LOMAS relation I was talking about. So What we did was to simulate the H1 distribution from the multi-dark Planck simulations. These are n-body simulations with a box size of 1 gigaparsec over h. And this error sheet 1 corresponds to an area of almost 600 degrees squared. So we decided to parameterize the median of the H1 Lemmas relation using these analytical expression here that depends on four three parameters, M0, a minimum, alpha, and gamma. We also included a scatter around this median to account for secondary dependencies, so a sigma parameter as well. So in order to simulate realistic H1 maps, we started from again, the H1 Lemmas relation we defined before, and we transform the density field of the H1 into brightness temperature. That's what you can see in the first panel here. We then accounted for the channel bandwidth and the telescope beam, and that's what we obtain. We accounted also for the foregrounds. As I said at the beginning, the foregrounds removing procedure is it's a big problem with in these topics, and also we simulated this procedure assuming that only the small radial modes cannot be distinguished from the foregrounds. So we applied an I-pass filter removing all the modes below this threshold here, and that's what we obtain. In the end, this means removing the mean temperature of the signal here, and that's why we have different color bars here, because essentially we remove the mean temperature of this map here. We accounted also for the thermal noise of the instrument, and we simulated the instrumental thermal noise as uncorrelated Gaussian fluctuation at pixel level. So basically, the thermal noise depends on the temperature of the system, on the integration time per pixel, and on the channel bandwidth we choose. So this is an example of a map of only noise that we added on top of the H1 map. So this is added on top of this map, and that's what we obtain. And in the end, we filter the output with a Gaussian filter in order to measure the statistics we are interested in. And in our case, the statistics we are using are the Minkowski functionals. So Minkowski functionals in two dimensions corresponds to the surface area, the perimeter, and the Euler characteristic of the body itself. The Euler characteristic is nothing more than the difference between the number of isolated regions and the number of holes within. And what is very interesting is that only considering all the free Minkowski functionals, we can really characterize the body we are considering. So for example, if we look at these two fields, they have the same area, the same area characteristic, but different perimeter. So we can distinguish between those. In this case, the isolated regions has the same area, the same perimeter, but a different Euler characteristic. So again, we can distinguish between the two fields. So in two dimensions for the field we are considering, we are using an excursion set formalism. So basically, we look at the map we obtain with the procedure I explained before. This is a map in units of temperature, of course. So we set a certain temperature, set a threshold. Tau 1, we look at all the regions above, so the dark blue ones here, and below, the light blue here, here, and so on, and we measure Minkowski functionals. Then we repeat the procedure with a different threshold, so we with a higher temperature in this case, we look at the regions here in blue, and the others in the light blue, and so on and so on. And what we obtain in the end is something like this. So in this case, the the maps you see on the left-hand side are obtained with the same H1 map. On the top of which we add a different level of thermal noise. So the different rows here, here, and here identifies different level of thermal noise. In the last case, we assume a noise-free ideal case. And these are the Minkowski functionals of the maps on the right hand side, and as you can see, with different level of thermal noise, the Minkowski functionals change a lot, both the amplitude, also the positions, and the shape of the Minkowski functionals. So if you see, for example, here and here, the scale is the same, but the two plots are quite different. And so we use the two-dimensional Minkowski functionals to analyze the maps we obtain, and we did that using a Fisher forecast analysis. So we change the three parameters, the four free parameters I show you at the beginning, alpha, m0, minimum, gamma, and this sigma parameter that is the scatter around the median. Changing these, we couldn't see any difference actually. So we couldn't constrain this parameter. But for the others, we obtained quite good results. So for example, you see that changing the parameters already changed a lot, the Minkowski functionals, and we were able to obtain constraints on the parameters as a function of the integration of time per pixel. We improve these constraints considering independent omega H1 measurements. And for all of the parameters, we obtain quite good constraints on the relative error of the parameters. But this can also be improved if we consider a broader redshift range. So not only what is happening in redshift one, but we consider redshift range of, for example, between 0.5 and 1.5. And the constraints are really improving. And so we show that we're using Minkowski functionals, we can actually constrain the H1 LMS relation, at least in the at this redshift. The second project I've been working on regards illuminization, as I said at the beginning. And again, in this case, we want to assess what we can understand about illuminization using ongoing and upcoming surveys. So once again, SK1 mid. And in order to do that, we consider aerodynamical simulations. So of course, this has the boxes we're considering are smaller than the one before because our aerodynamical simulations post-processed in order to solve the radiative transfer equation. We simulate SK1 mid like data cubes. So again, we consider instrumentational effects such as the angle resolution, the thermal noise, and so on. And then we measure the power spectrum of this signal for different models, and we compare the results. So the first model we consider is from Compostela Cantrupo-Porciani, 2013. In this case, illuminization is driven by AGNs, and AGNs that turn on a redshift 5. And the effect is that the illuminization ends at a redshift around 3. And you can see it in the first two columns here. In the first one is the fraction of single ionized helium, and in the second one, the fraction of double ionized helium. And you see at the ratio 2.7, there is no more single ionized helium, but only double ionized helium. The second model is from Garalli, Compostela, and Porciani, 2019. And in this case, the model incorporates the quasars luminosity function from Giallongo et al., 2015. And quasars provide enough power to ionize both H1 and single ionized helium. And so in this case, ionization is complete around the redshift 5, so much earlier respect to the first model. So we can see the same in the last row here. That's the fraction of double ionized helium. And as you see at redshift 6, pretty much everything is ionized except for these regions here. So at redshift 5, everything is fully ionized. Okay. That's the fraction of neutral helium, synchronized helium, and WNI's helium for the two models. So I just want to show the, how in the first one, at the beginning, we have only synchronized helium, then decrease, of course, while the amount of WNI's helium increases. While in the second model, the one with quasars, at the beginning, everything is still neutral, so we have only neutral helium, while as time goes by, helium is ionized once and then twice. So that's single ionized helium and that's double ionized helium. And here in the bottom panel, it's just the diffraction of single ionized helium we have in the different runs of the simulations we considered only for the second model. And again, once again, Arashid 5, everything is fully ionized and we don't see anything anymore. So in order to study these processes, we decided to use the to compute the power spectrum of the brightness temperature signal, power spectrum defined in this way as usual, and we can compare the power spectrum for the two models. Here, please note that the y-axis has different scales here and here. And of course, if we compare, for example, the first one, redshift 4.8, so the dark blue power spectrum, continuous line here, and what's happening here, the redshift 4.7, the orange one here, it's very different. The amplitude is three order of magnitude different, because of course in this case at this redshift there is nothing to be seen anymore. As I said, we need to account for the frequency bandwidth, the angle resolution, and the foreground removal procedure and the thermal noise. And so we did it also here. That's in blue, the original signal. And then we applied all the correction, the channel bandwidth, the Gaussian filter, and so on. And we added the thermal noise. We simulated thermal noise and we added on the top of the signal after we applied the Gaussian filter. And so these in black is what we obtain at the end and what we studied. We wanted to connect the total observational time and the power spectrum we obtain. So we define the signal to noise ratio in this way. So it depends on the K mode we are choosing, on the range of the beams we are selecting, the volume of the simulation we're considering, and of course the power spectrum and the power spectrum of the noise. And in the figure here, so we see the total observational time needed to see a certain amount of signal to noise ratio as a function of the redshift for the two models. I don't know why there is not the legend here for the two colors, but of course the blue one represents the first model, so the late reionization model, and the second one the early reionization one. And what we see from the plot is that with a total integration time of 10 to the 5 seconds, which is still a lot, a few days, we can actually see if we can detect something in the redshift range between 3.5 and 4.5, actually. So if we dedicate this amount of time observing that region, we can see if there is or there is not any amount of single ionized helium. And so if the first or the second model is the right one to describe helium reionization. So I think I can just go to the conclusions here. Yes. So once again, I wanted to stress how intensity mapping can be important, is key to investigate the epoch of ionization and galaxy formation at lower redshift. In particular, SK1 mid will play a central role in this matter. But as I said at the beginning, we can also consider using different lines, different experiments to study other processes. For example, here in Bonn, we are deeply involved with SICAT Prime. It's a submillimeter telescope that will should be operative in the next months, hopefully. But I know that in Marseille, for example, you are involved with the Concerto and so on. Regarding the first project, the one about hydrogen ionization. We proved that Minkowski functionals of 21 centimeter intensity maps encode precious information about the H1 low mass relation. And as I already said, our modeling technique can be applied also to other emission lines, other redshift in the post-ionization universe, of course, to study the star formation history, the galaxy evolution, and so on. And regarding the second project, we measure the power spectrum of the singly ionized helium atom, the brightness temperature of the singly ionized helium atom. And we saw how this can inform us about the helium ionization model, so an early ionization versus a late ionization model. What I find very interesting also is that we don't know much about these epochs. Okay, they're very close to us because we're talking about redshift 3, 4 and so on, but still we don't know much about the main drivers of helium ionization, and this is central to understand the structure formation and evolution as well. So I thank you so much for your attention. And of course, if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer those. And I hope I was on time.
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect on time. It really happened since the start of the pandemic.
Okay.
I already see a question by Mathieu, please. Mm-hmm. I am wondering if also Mathieu is concerned by the 10 to the 3 years of observing time. It's a real forecast.
I have a question about it. It's pretty interesting, but I was wondering about the means of the functional.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you well. Maybe it's just my... Oh, okay.
No. Go.
Maybe it's the earphone which doesn't...
Oh, yeah, that's much better. Yeah. Thanks.
So I was wondering about the Minkowski functional. In real case, if the first experiment of intensity mapping would be very noisy, probably. So how sensitive are they to noise? Is it like power spectrum where it will just increase the error bars, or does it also noise affect?
Okay. So if it affects also the shape and the the shape of the Minkowski function, because as you see here I think it's very clear. We have a high level of thermal noise in this case. That's just the observational type of pixel, but it's very noisy, as you can see. For example, the comparison between this map and this one, this is the noise-free case. And yes, there are very much differences between the shape and the form and the position, also the Minkowski functionals. But what it's important, I think, is that we are able to characterize it and see, we know that there is a noise, it's just a matter of understanding how to consider it and work with that. Because in our case, we just wanted to compare different models in the end. We changed the parameters of this H1 low mass relation. And so we wanted just to compare that. And we saw that with, of course, high observational time, but in the end, not so high, we can distinguish those and constrain the parameters. So of course, it's a problem, the noise, but I think it's manageable.
Sorry, I don't remember if you mentioned the meaning of the error or the shed lines.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that, of course, sorry. So we use different, of course, realizations, and so the what you see, the continuous lines are the mean of what we obtain, and the shadows here are the scatter around this mean, because we...
And also in the next plot, in the plot with Minkowski functionals.
Here is the same. It's absolutely the same. So the blue line here is the Minkowski functional of these maps, only this one. But of course, we consider different maps, and we took the mean of the Minkowski functionals, and that's what you see with the different colors, and the shadow regions around those are just the scatter.
Guylaine, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I missed the beginning, sorry, so maybe it's a stupid question, but it's related to the same story about the Minkowski's function here. As far as I understand, to apply these statistics, you need a simulation, right? But you need to have the shape of the stuff. So,
well, what? Okay, yeah, I see your point. Not really, because I mean, what we did here was to use a feature forecast, right? So. Okay, no, sorry. We cannot model the Minkowski functionals because in this case, we're working with the weakly, in highly non-Gaussian fields. So we cannot provide a model for the Minkowski, an analytic model for the Minkowski functionals. But what we can do is, of course, start from the data. And once we are able to account for the thermal noise and so on, measure the Minkowski functionals and try to reverse the problem. So we can go from the Minkowski functionals to the model we think is the best one. And so,
okay, so this is not my question, sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Imagine the simplest mm-hmm. case. We have a Halo model with two parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so can we apply these statistics to this kind of model? No, I think we need a 2D model. We need to have the special distribution, I mean, in real life. No?
Yes, but I don't understand what's the problem. I mean, from the observations, we can obtain these two-dimensional maps. Of course, when we observe, we have the full data cube. Okay.
Okay. So now my question is the following. Sorry, it's to apply these things in real life. So how we can do? Because so we imagine we have a map,
mm-hmm.
then we compute the area, perimeter, whatever.
Yeah.
And then how we can produce. Imagine we want to do that with C2, for example. How we could produce what we expect as the area perimeter with mm-hmm. a model.
Ah, okay. So you mean we did simulations before to compare the...
Okay, so you have to do a real simulation. You cannot use a simple model like a Halo model, for example. You have to do a 2D, 3D simulation.
We have to do the simulations, yes, in order to understand, to compare the Minkowski function we measure in real life, okay, with the Minkowski function we obtain from the simulations, yes.
Okay, so when we have this kind of, okay.
Yeah.
So because when you are doing simulation of galaxies, okay, I mean, you are simulating with dark matter halos and so on, then you have so many parameters and empirical laws, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. it's very hard to constrain that, right?
Yeah, so, actually something similar happened also in this work because we weren't able to constrain these last parameters. It was the scatter on the median of the H1 Elo mass relation. So of course there are some parameters we cannot constrain because the thermal noise is too wide and so on.
It's not linked to the thermal noise, even if you have no noise.
No, but yeah,
you
anyway,
have to do
yeah.
as many simulations as
yes. It's yeah, I agree. If there are many, many, many free parameters, it could be difficult to obtain the simulations and so on. Yeah, because it takes time to produce the simulations. Yes.
Because we have some trouble to measure the power spectrum. So I was wondering mm-hmm. if you could use this kind of statistics, but okay. Yeah. And how it deals with when you have, for example, in real life a map with holes everywhere because you have been forced to mask, how these statistics behave to that? Power spectra is dramatic, but mm-hmm. how it is for Minkowski functionals?
To be honest, we didn't try that. So, and I'm not sure if there is any work that do something like that right now. So I'm not sure if I would be able to answer. But again, I think it's just a matter of modeling and... I think we could think about it, but I'm not sure about the answer right now. Yeah. How to, yeah. Because, but I think yeah. Something could be done, but I will need to think about it. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I just have one more question. Then I have mm-hmm. other, but I don't want to monopolize the question. You said that SECAP-P will arrive hopefully next month.
year or so, he really...
Ah, next year, not next month.
No, no, I mean, should...
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Because,
I mean, it was supposed to start last year, but of course it was delayed, and now I'm not sure in the end when they will really start to be operative. But yeah.
But this is a telescope anyway, so the instrument will be much later. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, because you say last month, so I was...
No, sorry, maybe I... No.
Don't worry.
In the next... hopefully in the next year, should start. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Matthew, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Much less... technical question is just a sort of just curious about a sort of open-ended opportunity I see. So from two different perspectives, quasar surveys could be important. For one thing, with regards to helium reionization, I'm thinking in particular because these very large quasar surveys, you know, across very sort of many thousands of square degrees. So for one thing, I think we're beginning to approach something we might be confident is complete samples of quasars. So if you're interested in helium reionization and you think that at the very least quasars are a strong contributor, then one should talk about combining these different surveys together to see. I'm not sure how, again, this is why this is a very non-technical point I'm making. And further, there is a mostly unmined resource for studying helium reionization, which is the metal absorption in quasar spectra. So my former student, Sean Morrison, who you may know.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So he wrote a paper, we wrote a paper on studying the metal absorption with regards to quasar proximity. Right. And with this, so this is with the intention of studying UV background modulation, helium reionization. So I don't have a concrete, so maybe to turn this into a question, do you have any ideas about how you could combine your studies? I mean, the crude thing would just be maps and cuts, but is there something smart one could do to combine with both the quasar positions and the quasar absorption as a probe?
Right. I'm thinking about it. No, I think it's a good point.
Maybe you think about it and get back to me. Because, I mean, I think I can help with that. I think it would be very interesting. I put this to you and to anyone else who works on this stuff. You know, I think it's an interesting question, but I'm not sure. Yeah. It seems like something is there, right?
Yes. But probably need to, think about it. Thanks for the suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah. Any more question or comment? Well, if not, thank you again, and Benedetta, we can stop here and just let me advertise